Let's see if our guest is on in here. Yes, it looks like it. So let's cue a little bit of music. This will be an episode of Call Me Ignorant after the fact. Our guest coming on in a second has been on the show, I think, about a month and a half ago. Jake Chansley, the so-called by the media QAnon shaman, who is videographed, who was filmed at the Capitol in his getup. And we actually met briefly at America Fest in Phoenix. And boy, was this guy a celebrity over there. So he's also been doing some Twitter spaces lately about aliens, about spirituality. And that's some of the stuff that we're going to talk about today. And he's also running for office in Arizona. So we'll get into that and more. Let's bring our guest on in the room. Jake, welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on.
What's up, brother?
Hey, man. How you doing?
Doing good. How about yourself?
Pretty good, man. Pretty good. It was good to meet you in person briefly at America Fest. So I guess we'll kind of just start there. I don't know, man. You're a celebrity. It was cool. People were taking your picture, and you're in your shaman getup. But did you have a good time there in Phoenix?
Yeah, it was good. I enjoyed it. I can definitely say that there's a certain level of gatekeeping going on events like that, but I suppose that's par for the course.
Yeah, absolutely. Why don't you describe that? I mean, of course, me and my fans agree on the gatekeeping thing as well. Why don't you just tell us a little bit about your thoughts on that, and who's doing the gatekeeping? What does that entail? Why don't we just start there?
Well, I think the people that are doing the gatekeeping are the higher level organizations that seek to make a profit or turn a profit from the conservative masses. Anything that might possibly affect their bottom line, they are not going to do. Any subject that they might have an opinion about that might run counter to their base that is paying them to be there, they're not going to talk about. And in this way, the financial world actually plays a very big role when it comes to what is discussed in conservative circles and at events where we should be discussing some of the more controversial issues, and we shouldn't be worrying about a bottom line or profit.
Yeah, that's a good point. So people talk about the corporations, you know, they are trying to turn a profit. And, you know, I think me and you and most people that have good intentions, we're basically in the truth business. It's not really a commodity. It's hard to sell the truth, but you're saying that people that are not necessarily from the outside, but they're not in the truth business. They're in the money business. They want to, you know, and it's one thing I noticed, and I've been to CPAC a bunch of times, and now this is my first time at America Fest. Branding is a big part of it. You know, everyone's on the floor shilling their book, or not that, I mean, books are interesting because it is information and you can write a book that is truthful, but very much branding and marketing. And do you see that as a negative thing?
Well, I'm all for capitalism and entrepreneurship. What I'm not for is allowing financial status to take precedent, because at that point you're going to have kind of like in Braveheart, where you had all the Scottish lords gathering together and deciding on what they were going to fight upon or fight about or whatever. Lands, titles, food on the table, families, they all have a lot to lose. But like, well, what William Wallace said, well, does the man on the battlefield, does he stand to lose less? You know? And I think that when it comes to some of these, not all, but some of these conservative influencers, they are like the Scottish nobles, the Scottish lords, and they're thinking about their land, their titles, their status. They're not really thinking about the long-term ramifications of playing within the lines. And I think that playing within the lines is how it is that the masses are controlled.
And that's a great comparison. I mean, and William Wallace, you know, essentially, you know, I know it's a movie and I know it's not very historically accurate. I do get some flack from one of my friends for talking about Braveheart because he's into that history. But yeah, they're operating in some sort of currency, and, you know, money can get you status, and status can get you money. Followers can get you money. Money can get you followers. And it becomes almost like a machine, you know, a machine that perpetuates itself. I mean, if you don't mind, can you give give me some examples of some of these influencers that you think are nefarious in that way?
Well, I certainly do not trust Matt Gaetz.
Mm.
Not one iota.
No.
You know, I was watching to see who had the courage to take a picture with me in my regalia. And let's just say that there were a couple of people that were embracing it. And then there were a couple of people where it was like, nope, 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 nope. And I don't know if that's because of the Mockingbird Media's narrative, if it had to do with January 6th, if it had to do with the fact that in their conservative circles, I look, you know, like a Looney Tune in the regalia. But regardless, the footage that Tucker Carlson aired, I think is indicative that there's far more to me than what it seems on the surface or what the Mockingbird Media said. So I don't like naming names unless the time calls for it. But I'll just say all you got to do is go to my Twitter feed and see who took a picture with me and then see who didn't.
Yeah.
And, you know, some people might be more busy than others. You know, Matt Gaetz purposefully did not take a picture with me.
Okay.
He avoided me on three separate occasions, made eye contact each of those times, refused to take a picture, and then had the audacity to go out on stage and start talking about the plight of January Sixers. Whereas somebody like Marjorie Taylor Greene actually had the courage. She actually pulled me backstage and talked to me for 15 minutes and then took a picture. How hard is that, Matt Gaetz? How hard is that?
That's a little surprising with Matt Gaetz because he's, you know, he's branded as a controversial guy and he is a little bit more, I don't know, like hardcore or whatever, but, and he does talk about J6 and he made eye contact and just wouldn't. That's very strange because you're a personable guy. I mean, maybe it's a generational thing. I like the getup. I think it's, I don't know. That's very interesting.
A lot of people do.
Yeah.
A lot of people do. And that's why I think that it's rather silly that there's so much trepidation about a photograph or a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Because if they were actually keeping their finger on the pulse and seeing what the base likes and what they think, then they would see that having any sort of even tangential association through a picture or a conversation would not be detrimental to their public image.
100%. Yeah, I mean, unless they're trying to play, and this is a conversation that I have a lot on my show, unless they're trying to placate and play to the left, but people like Matt Gaetz and Marjorie Taylor Greene, I mean, they're essentially just Nazis to the left. So you basically have to win over the right. That doesn't make any sense to me, but that, I don't know. I'll keep that. Maybe one day I'll try to get a picture with Matt Gaetz. I'm not as famous as you and see if he, there's something shifty about that guy. I do get used car salesman vibes from that guy a little bit. And I think there's games underneath the game with him, but I don't know. Do you,
I'm quite certain that Matt Gaetz is corrupt.
Mm.
I think that he is in one way or another, selfish and focused on himself and his own aspirations for influencer status or power or fame of some sort. I've heard some things the way that he went to the Caribbean with underage girls and, the way that he was bragging about taking erectile dysfunction medication and drinking a Red Bull so he can go all night. Yeah. You know, when you have things like that, when you have skeletons like that in your closet, then, you know, you're going to be really trepidatious about what it is that you say and do.
Yeah, interesting. So, yeah, speaking of, you know, it's good transition. Just speaking of political aspirations, are you running for state Senate? Is that, do I have that right?
No, I'm running for the U.S. Congress.
U.S. Oh, that's U.S. I got that wrong. Dang it. Rare L for me as an interviewer. So you're running for U.S. Congress. Tell us about let's just get into your campaign. Are you doing a conventional? I can maybe predict that you're not going to be doing something so conventional, just the kind of guy that you are. But tell us about your campaign. What are you standing for as a politician? That whole deal.
Well, I'm not a politician, that's for sure. My campaign is built on or based on four promises to the American people. The four promises are as follows. The first piece of legislation that I'm going to introduce in the Congress is a single bill voting law. Second is going to be an amendment for term limits for congressmen and staff. And that's very important. Third is a criminalization of lobbying. And fourth is seven-figure fines, expulsion, and prosecution for all Congress members caught insider trading.
Wow. Cool. So basically, I mean, for lack of a better word, an anti-corruption, I don't know what the word is, I guess platform.
Well, you know what's funny about that is that both Matt Gaetz and Representative Khanna out of California, after I did my interview with Newsmax on November 13th, I believe that Khanna brought the bill to the floor on the 29th, but they were chattering about three elements to my campaign platform, three elements, which is getting rid of lobbying and getting rid of insider trading and term limits, were all proposed in this little bill of theirs. After I talked about it on Newsmax and did an international or did a national interview. And dude, I was talking about this stuff when the Speaker of the House seat was vacant in, I think October 3rd is when I threw my headdress into the ring and said, I'll do it. I'll be Speaker of the House. And these are the things that I would do. And these are the first things. And these are why. And lo and behold, on that list, the first things I would do, single bill voting, term limits, criminalization of lobbying, and getting rid of insider trading.
Yeah. Wow. Well, yeah, it's an interesting question about politics that, you know, I think it was Lauren Boebert and Marjorie Taylor Greene that one of them floated a bill to impeach Joe Biden and the other kind of stole it. And there's this question of who gets credit versus what gets done. And how would you see, you know, let's put it this way. Say you get elected and then someone way more high profile than you wants to take your bill and put their name on it. Would you be okay with that in the name of it getting done? Would you want the credit? How do you see that whole thing?
I have a friend from Ireland. He says, credit's for losers. I don't care about credit. Okay? Yep. Okay. I really don't. All right. What matters to me is that change takes place, that things get done. The only trepidation I would have about that is I would want to be the one that writes the bill, because the thing is, and this is part of the issue that I have with people like Khanna and Gaetz doing what they're doing, is that they're going to write the bill. And in doing so, they may very well on the surface make it appear that this is what they're attempting to accomplish. But below the surface, they write in all sorts of loopholes that allow business to continue as usual. So if I'm going to write the bill, I'm going to make it as restrictive and as concrete as possible, where no, anything and everything on the floor, whether it be House or Senate, single issue, no ifs, ands, or buts. And I don't want anyone in the Congress to be like, oh yeah, hey, I'll take that. And then they go in and then they write some shit and make some loopholes. No.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Very, very good point. Because, yeah, it kind of just reminds me of, you know, they have these militias in Africa or, you know, even North Korea. It's called the Democratic Republic of North Korea. So you can put a name on something. You can call it the, you know, America Wins Act, but you could write in the act that America's going to lose. So that's very astute. Yeah. You want to be the one that writes it.
The Patriot Act, the COVID relief bill, build yes. back better.
Yes.
Right? Like they always put these pleasant little titles because nobody's going to sign or get behind a bill that says fuck America Act. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And that's essentially what a lot of these things do. Detain American Citizens Act.
Yes.
You know, that's essentially what the Patriot Act is. Now, this is also important to understand about these bills, okay? And this is why, in particular, the first thing I'm going to do is a single bill voting law. And that's because a lot of these omnibus bills are like 2,000-3,000 pages, sometimes more. And the Congress member is given these bills by their staff who wrote them, not the Congress member. And they're told, okay, we're voting on this in 48 hours. Now, all it takes is a single little line in those 2,000 to 3,000 pages, right, to just completely trash the Constitution or the American system, to screw the voter, the American voter, and to move public money into private hands. A great example, here in Arizona, there was a bill that was passed, several hundred pages, if not, like, I think over 1,000. And in that bill, the Democrats snuck in one line, one little line that basically said that all there was no Republican precinct committeemen allowed in Arizona. And a bunch of fucking Republicans signed it because they didn't read the damn bill.
Dang.
Yeah. And so it created this huge scandal. There was a big uproar for like a couple of weeks or like a month or two. There were no Republican precinct committeemen. And think about this. There's more than one bill that these people are voting on. So like they could be getting 3-4 bills of 2,000 to 3,000 pages that they're told to read in a period of a week. And it's like, dude, you're not reading this stuff. You're just passing it. You're just there. They are a face in front of the camera to say the lines. They're actors. The Congress members have become actors. The lobbyists, the corporations, the staff who work for the lobbyists and the corporations. And in some cases, the staff actually get paid more than the actual Congress member. These are the individuals running DC from behind the scenes. And the single bill voting law is so important because it would actually tie the hands of those individuals and force them to write these things single issue. Now, this is another thing that's also important to understand. The Republicans or the Democrats could easily write single issue law. They could easily do it right now. The Republicans in the House or in the Senate could easily write a border bill and say, this is what we're going to do. We're going to reinforce the border. We're going to move all this money to the border. We're going to amp up security. We're going to build the wall, all of that stuff. But they don't do it. Mm-hmm. Why?
Question kind of answers itself. Yeah, exactly. You know, that's one of the things, even when I was a liberal and I heard about these, you know, I was a liberal living in DC and I heard about these omnibus bills. And I've been an avid reader my entire life, and I just would kind of do the math. Like, you know, you're talking about a 2,000 page bill. And then, like you said, you get 48, 72, sometimes 72 hours, sometimes a week to read it. It's got to be the staffers. And you're one of the first people that I've heard talk about term limits for staffers. Obviously this term limit for the president is 2 terms and there's no term limits on the Senate and the House. What kind of term limits are you seeing for the staffing?
For staff and Congress members, 8 years maximum. Mm. Because the thing is, dude, is a lot of the time, what if we didn't make term limits for staff, and a part of that bill would also be that Congress members cannot become staff. Is the Congress member will work in the Congress with the same staff over and over and over and over and over again. So if we do term limits for just Congress members, but not staff, what will happen is that the Congress member will work in there for 8 years and then they'll just become a staff member and become, you know, a part of the DC swamp as a staff member, getting paid more than the Congress member.
Yep.
So what we want to do is create a situation through the legislation and the legal system to ensure that corruption cannot be allowed to flourish. And so that means that staff members and Congress members have a certain allotted amount of time that they are allowed to be in the Congress. Mm. And there's some people that are going to say, yeah, well, you know, you're just getting your feet wet after the first 2 to 3 or 4 years, you know, and then after you finally start to understand how DC and the legal system works, you got to leave. Well, I once heard a saying, and it was that major failure comes after repeating small mistakes every day. And we have been repeating small mistakes that turn into big mistakes and causing major failures. So if that means that we got to get new people in DC that have to learn the ropes and the government moves a little bit slower, then so be it. Because what we're doing now isn't working.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. And, you know, the only devil's advocate that I would play on this is I wouldn't, you know, if I was just wondering about arguments against term limits, it wouldn't be from this, because I think that whole thing is ridiculous as far as, oh, it seems like we're always in an election. Oh, you're just getting your feet wet and then you're in an election so you can never get anything done. The only devil's advocate I would play against that is, like, what do you think about, you find the perfect guy, you find the perfect person, they're the best ever, and you just want them in there for 60 years. Now that there's not a lot of precedent for that, I will concede. But what if it's just the perfect guy? Like, for instance, you're running, you think you're pretty good. What if the perfect person's in there and I want them to stay in there for life? I mean, that's kind of, you're describing a king, or you're describing some sort of, you know, lifetime membership. What do you think about that?
The perfect person is going to create legislation or a system that does not necessitate their presence. It's kind of like, yeah, you know, a good parent raises a child to the point to where they don't need the parent anymore. Okay. A bad parent is one that keeps the child dependent on the parent. Mm-hmm. I think that the perfect person is a person that doesn't want the power. They don't want to stay. They want to create a system that creates independence for every man, woman, and child for generations to come, not dependence. And that is possible. It's 100% possible.
Yeah.
Now think about it. You could do something like be a representative for 8 years and then be a senator, right?
Yeah.
But at the most, that's 16 years at the most. And you can't become a staff member in either case. So the point is that in the Congress, as well as in the presidency, and even in some cases in the courts, there's been an environment of dependency that has been created for the American people to the congressman or to the president or whatever. And what the founders envisioned was a system that created and defended independence for the American from the government. That is entirely possible to do in 8 years of being a Congress member, assuming there's enough Congress members that have the balls or the ovaries to actually go along with something that is going to dismantle the corrupt system and force them to get another fucking job.
Yeah. Wow. And so, you know, one thing that you mentioned a second ago that I'm wondering about, would you do away with the lifetime appointment for Supreme Court justices as well? Would you put term limits on that?
I think that when it comes to Supreme Court justices, like Ruth Bader Ginsburg, like she literally died as a Supreme Court justice. Like, how do we know that her mental faculties were sharp? I think that if we're going to deal with something like that, there should be mental acuity tests that are taken. And that is prior to a certain age limit being reached. I think that around 75, because what we want is wise people in the courts that have a lot of experience with the legal system. And so age is not necessarily the same factor as it is, like, for example, in the Congress. But at the same time, I think prior to that 75 age limit, there should be like every year, mental acuity tests. Let's see where your head's at. Let's see where your cognition capabilities are at. And if you pass with flying colors, okay, cool. But the moment you hit 75, it's time to retire. Sorry.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. Well, last thing I want to ask you about politics, then we'll get into some other stuff. You want to criminalize lobby groups, lobbying, basically. What do you, you know, I am pretty much in favor of that. I don't know how much that would, what would that look like? But my point is that it, you know, lobbyists are basically, it's an interest group. Everyone has interests. Groups have interests. Families have interests. Racial groups have interests. Cities have interests. How do you go about, well, before we get into going about criminalizing it, what are lobbyists, what is it to lobby to you, and why do you see that as a bad thing?
Lobbying is a legal form of bribery.
Okay.
That's I see what you're saying. That's what it is.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
And it's a loophole that was created by corrupt Congress members with dollar signs in their eyes and corporate or special interest groups wringing their hands and rubbing them together and being like, yeah, we could do this. We could do that. We just have to give them this amount of money. We just, you know, now is that going to ensure indefinitely that corruption will not exist? No. Getting rid of lobbying is a part of the solution. Because the thing is that, let's just say for the sake of argument that this bill ends up getting passed and there's a criminalization of lobbying, which means that there's no, lobbying is a middleman between a special interest group or an NGO and the Congress member.
I see.
Okay.
Yep.
So that's the lobbyist. The lobbyist is the guy. Have you ever seen Thank You for Smoking?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. The main character in that movie was a lobbyist for the tobacco companies. And lobbyists, like it shows in that movie, are without conscience in many cases. Their interest is entirely to their institution, even at the expense of the individual, or especially at the expense of the individual. So even if you were to get that bill passed, there would still be things like these special interest groups inviting Congress members to orgies. You know what I'm saying?
Yep.
Or, here's a line of cocaine. Yeah, we got a bunch of hookers over here if you want, type of thing. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And given the environment in D.C. and the swampy nature to it, some of these Congress members would likely just succumb to their lusts and their greed.
Yeah.
But what it's about is creating obstructions to corruption. And criminalization of lobbying through the legal system is one of those obstructions. And so is the seven-figure fines, expulsion, and prosecution for insider trading. Because a lot of these Congress members that are pushing through these bills, that these omnibus bills that have spending or investments of tax dollars into NGOs or corporations or whatever, they are looking at this and they're going, okay, I'm going to invest in that stock.
Yeah.
Before this bill passes.
Yeah.
And then they go and they buy up a bunch of stock. Well, where did they get the money to buy up a bunch of stock? They got it from the lobbyists. They got it from the NGOs, you see? And another element to, you know, stopping lobbying and how it may not be as it's the first step is that a lot of, like, if you look at AOC, how is she a millionaire? How is she a millionaire? And the answer is because she says the talking points that the special interest groups or the lobbyists, the international corporations, these NGOs, she says a lot of the things that these institutions want people to hear. So what she does, what she's used for, is she's propped up in front of the camera as a congressman. And then they say, hey, come over here. And say the line in front of the camera, say the line in front of this massive mob of people that's screaming they want socialism, and we'll give you like 300 grand.
Yeah.
Right? So that's another element to this.
Yeah.
Where it's like, it's not going to, the criminalization of lobbying is a step in the right direction because that means that anyone and everyone that's caught overtly doing these things has legal trouble to worry about.
Yeah.
But then there's other elements to it where it's like, well, corruption can still exist. We just have to make it more difficult through the legal system, because at the current moment, the legal system has made it very easy.
Mm. Yeah, good answer. Yeah, so it's about the you know, they, you know, just to, if I, correct me if I'm wrong, but there's all these vices. There's all these currencies that one can, you know, whether it, like you said, hookers, blow, you know, money. That's, you're just want to eliminate. We'll never eliminate sin, you know, but we can eliminate the dollars. That step of the process. And I think that's a really good take. I mean, so you wouldn't, it's not the advocacy, it's not the standing for an interest, it's that there's this dollar, you know, these are thousands of jobs and they're being propped up. They're the middleman, they're the bribe, they're the briber. So just eliminating that. So do I have that right?
Yeah. Cool. Yes, very much so. And same thing with the insider trading. Yeah. Because currently, all it is for insider trading for a Congress member is a $200 fine.
What?
Now, yeah, dude. So think about it. They can make $2 million on an insider trading deal that they are well aware of, and or the stock that they're well aware of, and then do insider trading and make money on it. And all they get if they're found guilty is, oh, here's a $200 fine. Yeah, here's $200. So they pay $200 to make $2 million. And you know, now here's another element to that most people just don't consider. Have you seen Wolf of Wall Street?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Isn't Remember it? When he was talking about rat holes, basically somebody that owns stock in your name, and then they give you the kickbacks on the money?
Yeah.
So that is another element to this whole insider trading thing, where it's like there are illegal loopholes that people can go through. And considering the criminal element to a lot of people in Washington, D.C., I wouldn't put it past them to have some rat holes for some of these stock that they would want to invest in. Yeah. However, that is illegal. So not only would they get caught, but so would the person be in the rat hole for them. And it's a lot easier for the government to lean on the rat hole and say, hey, you're going down for this guy. They set you up. You know, and then lo and behold, the Congress member gets pinched. So I guess my thinking is like I said, stopping corruption entirely, like you said, you're not going to stop sin, right? So stopping corruption entirely is difficult because we have free will. And there's all sorts of ways for corrupt people. Criminals don't obey the law regardless. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So, but the trick here is to create a system that does not allow corruption to flourish. And currently, we don't have that system. Currently, we have a system that allows corruption to become the status quo.
Yeah. Yeah, it's built into the cake. We need to not build it into the cake. Yeah. Good answer, man. Well, yeah, I think that you got to, I hope that you win. You know, I really, how do you like your chances for, I mean, I don't know who you're running against or anything like that, but how do you like your chances for getting into office?
Well, I think they're great. I just needed the signatures to get on the ballot.
Hmm. Okay. Does that have to be people? It's people in your district in Arizona.
Yeah. In District 8 here in Arizona, okay. They have to be libertarian, independent, or no party affiliation.
Oh.
Which does make it slightly difficult, but not impossible.
Okay. Gotcha. Well, yeah, I mean, let's move on to something else, but make sure we'll be in contact in the DMs, and you send me anything you want me to share out. We can, cause I know we have some listeners in Arizona, so, you know, send
Shaman,
me whatever.
Hey. ShamanForCongress.com. That's Shaman, ForCongress.com.
Okay.
And anybody that goes to the website, it's right there. As soon as you scroll down a little bit, you can sign the petition.
Okay. Sounds good. I will put that in my notes. So, what, you know, the last thing I want to talk about here is, and it might take a while, but I mean, you've been doing these spaces. I hopped in a couple of them, and you're talking about spirituality. You're talking about interdimensional beings. You're talking about aliens, things like that. I don't know if you've been, I know you have your, I guess they're called courses on your website. What made you start to do these spaces? You know, that whole deal, let's transition to that. But yeah, why do you do these things on spaces and not just on your courses now?
Well, because I like talking about it. I think that stuff's way more interesting than politics.
Cool. Yeah.
As a shamanic practitioner, spirituality is paramount to me. And I think that the whole reason why our socioeconomic and geopolitical systems are so corrupted and distorted is because our spiritual systems and our spiritual perspective have become so corrupted and distorted. And if you correct the spiritual, then the socioeconomic and geopolitical will mirror that correction. Why I've chosen to do stuff on spaces instead of the free courses. I mean, I put out that the free courses are up for people that want to check it out. I put them up in the nest and stuff like that. But because for whatever reason, I guess people are more inclined to on the fly listen to a space that's 2 or 3 hours than they are to sit down and watch a 1 hour video. So it's like, what matters to me is getting the message out there. And if that's how I have to do it, then so freaking be it.
I mean, it's, and it is interesting how people go where they don't really seek out things. You almost have to go to them as an audience. I've said before, if I get banned on YouTube, I mean, I will just lose a sizable part of my audience anyway, because that's when where I've been forever. So it's like you have to really prod them to get over to somewhere else. But if you go to some place like X/Twitter, the people are right there. So that's a good point. So here's what I'm wondering about. We can circle back to, you know, well, actually, no, let's do the aliens. That what are aliens to you? I know people have their thoughts that aliens are real. They're not real. It's a government op. They're just demons. There's all these different takes. What, you know, I listened to a little bit of one of your spaces, but not the aliens one. So tell us about aliens. What's your take on that? You know, that whole deal.
Well, let's start with this term extraterrestrial. Okay. Terrestrial means what? Like the land, you know, like Earth, terra, terrestrial.
Yep.
So that is indicating that there is another planet like Earth, for example, where there are physical beings that are walking around on, assuming, 2 feet, you know, and have brains and the ability to use radio signals to communicate or something, right? Or have created vehicles that allow them to traverse the ocean of space. I think that that is possible. In fact, I'm not saying that it's not the case. However, when we talk about other forms of life, we have to broaden our spectrum of perception, and we have to broaden our palate when it comes to what it is that we're willing to taste and digest as far as the definition for what these things are. Look at it like this. Humanity perceives less than 1% of the electromagnetic spectrum, right? So there could very well be entities, beings around us. In fact, there are around us all the time that are right outside of that less than 1% of the light spectrum. You know, things like the quote unquote spirit world or paranormal world, ghosts, angels, demons, artificial intelligence. All of these things are outside of the perception of our five senses. And they are existential beings. They do in fact exist. They just exist outside of the spectrum that we perceive. So in that sense, they are existing in another dimension of the electromagnetic spectrum that goes beyond the five senses. And some of them are advanced enough to where they have the capability to interact with beings within our little narrow portion of the spectrum. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'm right there with you, man. Yeah. Yeah. So you're not saying that aliens, as they're present, you know, terrestrial beings, physical beings from other planets, you're not saying they don't exist, but it's much closer. And I agree with you on that, that it's much closer to they are here. They exist. And, you know, whether you call them, like you said, ghosts, angels, demons, specters, whatever, that they're here among us right now, but they're outside of this, our observable spectrum, and they can enter it at some, and they can enter it, they can leave it. Do you think that they can, that they can enter it, or some can enter and leave it at will, or are they also bound by some other thing that controls that?
Yeah, they can, some of them can enter and leave at will. Others are, have to be beckoned or invoked.
Yeah.
And this is where we get into things like ceremonial magic and stuff like that, that there are certain codes that you have to basically like type into the computer or type into the matrix in order to manifest these entities or create an environment or like a portal of sorts that allow them to manifest.
Wow.
I don't recommend that people do that.
Cool.
It's like a child playing with fire. You're going to get burned and you might burn down your house. This is why I do not advocate for the use of things like Ouija boards.
Yeah.
That's, you know, if you really want to experience the paranormal, you really want to experience the spirit world, just eat a handful of mushrooms. You don't got to go fucking with the Ouija board, you know, or go out into nature on a vision quest. You don't even need to eat mushrooms. Go out on nature on a vision quest for 3 or 4 days, stay in one spot, you know?
Yeah.
There's all sorts of ways to get in touch and in tune. Fast for a couple of days or something, you know?
Dude, yeah. That'll get you in touch for sure. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
But the thing is that takes a lot of work, you know? And people want to just, like, you know, take a pill and all of a sudden, you know, see, you know, oh, the spirit world's real. So they pull out the Ouija board and they're like, let's see what happens. Let's see what happens. No. You're opening a door, a neutral door, and usually the only thing that walks through neutral doors are low-frequency entities that want to get out of whatever low-frequency dimension they're stuck in.
Wow. So how do you see this is the reason, I mean, like, when I have guests on, I'm not really here, it's not a debate or whatever, I'm just wondering, but I personally am opposed to psychedelics for that same reason. So I'm wondering how you differentiate doing some sort of spell, incantation, Ouija board versus taking mushrooms or LSD or whatever, you know, some sort of medicinal, for lack of a better word. I'm opposed to both those things for the same reason. How do you differentiate the two?
Well, first of all, I don't advocate for LSD.
Okay, cool. All right.
I think LSD is very dangerous. I do believe that it being a Schedule I drug is the appropriate scheduling for lysergic acid, diethylamide. Mm-hmm. It is measured in micrograms, which means that, you know, you a little bit spilled on your arm and you're in a mental institution for the rest of your life. That's very dangerous. But things like psychedelic mushrooms or peyote or ayahuasca or ibogaine or even cannabis for that matter in high enough volume, these things have been used for thousands of years in shamanic ceremonial settings. So the trick when it comes to the use of these plants or these fungi is you have to create the proper environment. You have to do them in the proper way in order to facilitate a divine spiritual experience. Taking a handful of mushrooms and going to a rock concert, or taking a bunch of mescaline and going to Bazooka Circus in Las Vegas, you know, these things are, this is not a good idea.
Okay.
And it's that's how you invite the negativity in, because you're not using it for spiritual purposes, you're abusing it for fun. And what ends up happening is that the shamanic practitioner calls the plant spirit or the plant teacher will start to abuse you as a means of getting you to straighten your act up. You know, I think that when the ancients were doing these things, they did them at specific days on specific astrological or solar alignments, certain planetary alignments, moon cycles, stuff like that, earth cycles, solstices, equinoxes and stuff. And they usually like prepped for at least a week or two before they did anything like that. So there was a lot of prayer. There was things like fasting going into play. There was a lot of devotion to ensuring that the experience was one of divinity and that the angelic spirits or the angelic side of the spirit world was what they made contact with. So just taking them, like taking a handful of mushrooms on a Tuesday evening or something because you want to trip balls. I mean, you're not, the potential for disaster is far more likely. And if you do it the other way, the shamanic way, then the potential for divinity and epiphany and bliss is far more likely.
Cool.
These are tools.
Yeah.
And similar to how you can use a hammer to build a house, or you can use a hammer to try to put out a fire on your head, one way is a good thing. The other way is not a good idea. So it's not the hammer that's to blame. It's who's holding the hammer. And the thing is, a lot of conservatives make the same argument about firearms. So in my opinion, it's almost like the mushroom or ayahuasca or whatever is like a spiritual firearm. And you can use it to defend against evil, or you can use it to hold people hostage. The question is, who is the tool in the hands of, and what are their intentions?
Well, yeah, I respect that answer, man. Yeah, that's a good way of, yeah. And it's totally, I mean, I've done a good bit of psychedelics when I was younger, and I totally agree that it's like the set and setting. And you know, just trying to, you know, I'm opposed to like getting messed up. You know, it's like, I'm going to use drugs to get messed up. I mean, like, I just want to not feel myself, not be on this earth right now. I think that that is just not right. But you're not describing it that way. You're describing it as a tool. So fair enough.
Well, the funny thing is that what I'm actually describing is not an escape from reality, but rather an integration into objective reality. A use of these tools to examine oneself in the spiritual mirror and deal with your shit. That's what I'm advocating for. And that's why, for example, the clinical trials with things like psilocybin mushrooms have gone so splendidly when it comes to getting rid of things like depression or anxiety or PTSD and stuff like that. Because like neurologically, these things actually create so much neural connectivity in the brain that it actually breaks up the cyclical nature to the brain patterns revolving around depression and anxiety and post-traumatic stress. So when you ingest these things in the proper set and setting, when you do it in the guidance of a shaman or a psychiatrist or something like that, and it's usually prefaced with weeks of preparation, then you have the capacity for real change in the mind, in the heart, in the body, in your life, because you're approaching it from the proper angle. But I don't advocate for like the ability to go down to the, you know, the convenience store and buy an eighth of mushrooms the way you can buy a pack of cigarettes. I think that's a terrible idea.
Yeah, not to be trifled with. Yeah, so we're almost out of time here. So one thing I wanted to ask you, and this might, you know, I don't know if you've done courses or space on this, but and I know that, you know, shamanic practices are not a monolith. So I'm just wondering what is your thoughts on? I mean, I'm a Christian. Jesus is my Lord and Savior. I go to church. I am the worship leader of church. What is your belief and what is your thoughts on Jesus Christ?
I think Jesus, or Yeshua, because that's his real name, was the ultimate shaman. If you look at what it is that Yeshua, or Christ, we'll just call him Christ, what Christ did, he behaved in a way that shamans have behaved for thousands of years. For example, healing people, that's a huge element in shamanism. Another thing is something called soul retrieval, which is basically going into the spirit world and finding a person's soul and bringing them back to their body. He did that with Lazarus. He also did it with the young girl that was supposedly dead, lying in her bed. He taught people how to pray, the Our Father, right? He taught his disciples how to meditate and stuff like that. He cast out demons, right? That's something shamans have been doing for thousands of years. And he also went through ordeals, which is a huge part of shamanism as well. Ordeals is basically taking on a very difficult task. And that difficult task causes the individual going through it to suffer a great deal, but doing so strategically so as to avoid negative timelines for the tribe. When I say negative timelines, I mean things like drought, famine, disease, warfare, chaos, death, etc. In shamanic cultures, they noticed that when the shaman or other tribal members did not go through these ordeals, then these negative timelines would manifest, where their crops didn't grow properly, they had droughts, people caught diseases, on the hunt people were killed, and stuff like that. So Christ, the 40 days and 40 nights in the desert, quite the ordeal, right? The passion, quite the ordeal. And finally, part of these ordeals is for the shaman to basically thrust themselves against the wall of death and not die, but rather to defeat death. And in the process of defeating death, their very life force itself acts as an anchor for positive timeline. And so if we look at 40 days and 40 nights in the desert, no food and water, holy shit, right? Thrusting the body up against death, defeating the devil, right? Tempted three times to go down an easy route, beat the devil there. And when it comes to the passion and the resurrection, once again, defeating death. And the way that created positive timelines, not just for the people of Judea or of Israel or the Hebrews, but for people all over the world, that his accomplishment echoed in eternity. It echoed for thousands of years. And I mean, the man ascended over 2,000 years ago and he's still saving lives. What he did is still having ramifications to this day. And in that sense, he's creating positive timelines.
Wow. So you do believe, do you believe in like his literal resurrection then?
Yeah, but I don't necessarily have the same belief that everybody else does about it.
Okay.
So let's talk about the Shroud of Turin for a second. They have come to find that the Shroud of Turin does not have blood marks on them, but actually it's like radiation burns, that they're burn marks into the shroud. And if you look into Tibetan tradition of what's called rainbow body, then I think that what happened is that Christ achieved rainbow body, which is ascension. And he did so inside the tomb after he was killed on the cross. And in doing so, he ascended metaphysically and physically into higher dimensions or into heaven.
Wow. Rainbow body. Okay. I just put a little fork in that. I'm going to look into that. Is one of your courses on your website on that? Or could you point us to it?
Yeah. If you go to my Rumble channel, Yellowstone Wolf AZ, you can also find a course called God is Real and Reincarnation is Physics. But I think Interdimensional Insights, the course on my website, Interdimensional Insights, I think that I cover rainbow body in that one.
Okay, cool.
There's another one I posted. It's on my highlights on my X page or my Twitter page. Mm-hmm. If you go to my highlights and you scroll down a little bit, you'll find Just Take the Red Pill. That's also on my Yellowstone Wolf AZ Rumble channel. And you'll also find the link to God is Real and Reincarnation is Physics. So, I cover it in those things, and I get a little more in depth. Yeah. What's interesting about the rainbow body thing, and this kind of correlates to this notion of the Shroud of Turin having burn marks, is that there's locations in both Tibet and in India where other individuals have also achieved rainbow body, and in some cases doing so in a cave. And there's a silhouette of a human being meditating on the cave wall that has these rainbows like burned into the wall. And outside of the cave, there is vitrified handprints and footprints in stone. Vitrification is when you heat stone to the point of it becoming glass. Mm-hmm. So there's vitrified handprints and footprints outside of the caves where these individuals achieve rainbow body. So this kind of is indicative that of the burn marks in the Shroud of Turin, because if they're able to burn, you know, a rainbow onto a stone wall, you'd better believe they're able to burn into cloth. And it's also indicative of the ability to move the stone, the thousand, several ton stone, you know, that's in front of the tomb like that. No problem. If they can vitrify stone, you better believe they're able to move a stone.
Wow. Very interesting stuff, man. I'll be looking at the stuff that you just plugged, especially the rainbow body thing, because a guy was just talking to me about the Shroud of Turin a couple months ago, talking about these burn marks, and I didn't know. I haven't looked into the Shroud of Turin that much, but yeah, man. Well, thank you for your time. This is a very interesting conversation. I hope to get you on again, and next time we'll probably do the whole time on this spiritual stuff. Because I agree. Like, I'm glad that you're running for Congress, but also I enjoy hearing and talking about these things a lot more than politics. Politics is kind of it's not even a necessary evil. It's just like a necessary lame thing in society. I don't know if politics is evil, but this stuff is the really interesting stuff. So thanks for coming on, and tell us, I'll have all the links below in the show description, but tell people, this will be a podcast, so tell people how to find you, best places to find you online. Okay.
Sure. On X or Twitter @AmericaShaman. That's AmericaShaman, @AmericaShaman on X or Twitter. You can also go to my website, ForbiddenTruthAcademy.com. That's ForbiddenTruth, T-R-U-T-H, Academy.com, where we have all sorts of free courses, free podcasts you can listen to, free interviews. There's literally dozens of hours at this point of content that's totally free. You can also check out my book, One Mind at a Time, A Deep State of Illusion, that's also on the website. And you can also check out some of the merch that we have. It's pretty kick-ass. You can go to my website, shamanforcongress.com. That's shaman, F-O-R, congress.com, where we have my campaign platform, why it is that these four things are essential that I'm running on, what the problems are here in District 8, how we can solve them, what the statistics are, as well as a bunch of interviews that I've done that are more oriented around politics and policy. Also, you can sign my petition to get on the ballot. As long as you are in District 8, as long as you are a libertarian, an independent, or no party affiliation, you can sign my petition as long as you're in District 8. Rumble, Yellowstone Wolf AZ, all one word. That's Yellowstone Wolf AZ. It's all one word. You can also find me on Rumble at the Occult Apocalypse Show. And that is the Occult Apocalypse Show, where we lift the veil on everything occult or everything that is unseen. And we basically dive into like Hollywood, DC, the Vatican, the London Palace, all that stuff. And we expose the Satanism and the occultism that's in all of these things. There's also a Forbidden Truth podcast on Rumble as well. If you want to, you can always just go to my website and find the podcast there too. So, with that being said, dude, I enjoyed this. I look forward to doing it again. I think that politics sucks. And unfortunately, we don't have real leaders in politics, and they're trying to use the levers of government power to push their own moral or immoral agenda on the rest of the population. So that is the grounds, the legal system is the grounds in which these less than one percenters have sought to push their nefarious spiritual agenda. So in that sense, I think it's an obligation as a shamanic practitioner to meet them on that field and to use nonviolence to push back against their evil agenda.
Amen. Well, I hope you win, man. I'll be following your campaign all year, and I'll be in touch next time we'll have you on. And thank you so much, and have a great day, all right?
Thank you. God bless.
Have a good one, Jake. God bless. Call me ignorant, everybody. Jake Anjali Chansley, QAnon Shaman, as presented by the media, but much deeper guy than just a dude yelling at the Capitol and things like that. I like him as a guest. I didn't get to a couple things, especially because a lot of these, Christian purists. I mean, I'm a Christian, but a lot of these purists on Twitter, a few of them told me to not have him on, to not have a conversation with the guy. He's awesome. We definitely disagree on some of the things about Jesus, but that's all right. I mean, next time I have him on, I will hit him with a couple of the verses about how Jesus says he's the only way and things like that. But he doesn't deny the resurrection. I mean, in a way, he doesn't. In a way, he does. I don't know. That's not a no shade being thrown at all. That's just a big topic that we'll get into next time. But thank you so much, Jake Chansley, for coming on the program. Call me ignorant. This will be uploaded, I believe, as a show in about a week and a half. So love you guys. Call me ignorant. I'm Steven. Follow me at JR Normus over there on Twitter and Ignoramus on Rumble. Stream every day, 10 a.m. Eastern time. Love you. Call me ignorant. Well, thank you so much for checking out the content today. I really hope that you enjoyed it. If you want to see more of this stuff, you can go over to my link tree and follow all of the different places where you can do my social media and the different places I stream. That's linktr.ee/ignoramusmedia. The top links are Rumble, Odyssey, and my two YouTube channels. I stream 10 a.m. Eastern every single weekday. Usually try to have one or two cool guests per week. But yeah, Ignoramus streams on YouTube, Ignoramus videos on YouTube for streams and videos, Odyssey and Rumble, and the main spot, like I said before, is the Rumble. So if you search Ignoramus over there on Rumble, rumble.com/user/Ignoramus. If anything ever happens as far as censorship, you can always find me on Rumble. But once again, the daily Ignoramus is 10 a.m. Eastern time every single weekday. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you around.